Competition, taxes, and the death of our public schools? Don't get too depressed. We will get down on the floor and play with the kids before this is all done. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From the New York Times, competition is ruining childhood and kids should fight back. Like the crack of a starting pistol, November begins the official college application season, sometimes for sophomores, by the way. But for students, this race started a long time ago. From kindergarten to 12th grade, schools brag about how competitive they are. That means it's not enough for students just to do their best. Whether in the classroom or the athletic field or at home on the computer, they must always be better. Youth has become a debilitating endurance test.
Wow. Thank God I'm not young.
I'm so glad I'm old.
Man.
I can't even. You know, it's funny, though. I threw in the whole sophomore college application. It's crazy now. Right. I remember when I was a senior and I was in high school way back in 1990. And I'm like, you know, okay, I'll start thinking about college now. You know, start it. And okay, there's a couple that'll, you know, I'll accept. But now they're thinking about it as eighth graders.
As someone who makes a living at the higher education, I'm surprised by the number of sophomores in high school coming to talk to me about what it would be like to come to my college.
Really?
And I always look at them, and I really do, and I go, you know what? Go back and enjoy high school first.
Good for you.
Okay?
That's
because
good.
The author here has a point. Mm-hmm. This competition is absolutely ridiculous.
Yes,
okay?
It is.
When you think of students staying up all night and you say, you know, I've got five AP classes, I'm in gymnastics, I'm carrying food for the poor,
right.
I'm doing this, and you ask them why. It's like, well, because I have to get into college.
Right.
Right? Okay.
It's for my college resume.
It's for my college resume. But here we go further into this, and the person says, okay, and when you graduate college, guess what? All of that work seems to be for naught.
Yep.
Because your ability and all of that extra work doesn't seem to translate into economic gain once you graduate from college, as compared to somebody who might have went through high school going, yeah, I'll do what I got to do. And I got into college, and I went through college, and I graduated. When we start comparing, quote, incomes of those people, there's no advantage.
Yeah.
And in fact, what we really need to compare, which is really cool, is mental attitude as an adult. Because those that are so stressed out, and we're finding more of this, and this is outside of this opinion piece, but there is more anxiety and more mental health issues from that early competition than from students who have a much more sense of balance.
Mm-hmm.
They are, in the long term, also financially, they're about the same. But if you put mental health and feeling good about yourself and well-being, those who just kind of did what they had to do are in a much better spot. So is this Busted Pencils advocating for laying back and being a slouch?
No, that's not it.
No.
But working your tail off, it's proving that more and better educated workers are earning less.
Right.
It's not proven that taking the five AP classes and being in gymnastics and band and football and everything else is going to do it.
And in fact, as Alfie Cohn, who is on our show with Cohn Zone, tweeted this week, you be careful of what colleges call competitiveness, because the reality, as this article points out, is that you may graduate from a, quote, competitive college. However, your wages may not be any further above those of us who went to those so-called less competitive colleges, which we called back in the day state colleges, right? Okay,
yeah.
So a place that took Slecker, not a bad place to be.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
Tax cuts. Oh my God. Yes, that's what we hear. They are coming. Tax cuts for you and me, the middle class. Well, let me explain to you how these tax cuts will work for me, Tim, the Busted Pencils host. My student loan, which I owe a ton of money on, I now will no longer get to deduct the interest from that. Awesome. That's a great tax cut for me. My son gets to go to college. with a tuition voucher. That tuition voucher now gets to count as earned income for me. Great. Another tax cut, supposedly, from what I understand. And then you add to that the fact that possibly I might have to also give up my tax deduction for my home? Wow. How in the hell is anybody ever going to put this forward as a tax cut for the middle class? And look, let's understand that education, the idea that you're going to give people in the middle class who are trying to pursue their education a tax cut when you take away the interest from their interest income deduction and then you tax income that they don't actually get, which actually help get their kids through college. Come on, guys. This isn't a tax cut. This is actually a tax hike. On Tim, the host of Busted Pencils. Can you imagine what it's doing to other middle-class people?
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
I would like to revisit a topic. Matt Damon's mom was pretty harsh the last time she talked about personalized learning. I wonder what she thinks about it now.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Yeah.
Dr. Nancy, personalized learning, I told you that I wanted to revisit this because some students, and I'll set the context that I've been working with, think that personalized learning has a bad name.
Yeah. You know, when I first heard, I've been in education for 40 years. When I first heard this term personalized learning, I thought, what's wrong with that? Like, what's the problem? Of course we do personalized learning. And then I realized that it had been co-opted, that term, by the digital learning people.
Uh-huh. See, and that's what, you know, I wondered, is this a co-optation of what should have been a good term?
Absolutely. Because personalized learning, well, this shows you how word meanings have personal interpretations, and we have to always be careful with words and trying to understand what people mean by them, because it can be very different things. But in a world of good education, we would hope that learning would be very personalized and that teachers would be working with individual kids, know them very well, know their interests, their developmental levels, their cultures, their skills, and be able to teach them in an individualized kind of way. Even when teachers work in groups, there are all kinds of ways they know how cooperative learning and small groups and so forth to adapt to the needs of individual unique learners. But so it should be part of all education, but it's this term now has to be deconstructed when you're talking to people, because some people may not mean at all what I just said, but otherwise they might mean a scripted, you know, predetermined computer-based program that a student is working through, that every student is working through, the same program.
Yeah, and let's...
Step by step.
Right, and let's, you know, we need to be honest, because of the co-optation, that somebody to hear personalized learning right now, to automatically assume plug-and-play, device-driven, students sitting in isolation really isn't that far off for people to go, because I thought about it when I heard that too, is especially when I've seen it in practice, you know, personalized learning, self-directed lessons, self-correcting. We've seen it pushed by some of our tech giants like Bill Gates, and in fact saying that if you did really great device-driven learning, personalized, we could reduce the need for classroom teachers.
Yeah, that just isn't true. See, that just shows a deep ignorance of what is education.
Mm-hmm.
Because education is the interaction of subject matter and learner. It's very dynamic, it's very exciting, and it's always changing. And the learner has a lot to do with shaping what that interaction looks like. This is the most fundamentally core idea that has gone on in this country now and just taken over, is that Gates and so many policy people think that education can be pinned down and written down and put in a script and directly taught into the empty heads of the learner who is just passive and going to take it in. That isn't education.
Well, we don't have, as far as the last time you and I checked, we don't have passive receptacles that sit in front of us waiting to be filled.
Right. We... That's right.
You know, I mean, they've got their own thoughts. They've got ideas. They understand things the way they understand them. And so going back to the old idea of learning theory, the empty vessel that needs to be filled just doesn't fit. And so the idea of plugging and playing and attaching students to a device that's going to fill that empty vessel is a shallow way to think about learning.
It's shallow, and it's also assuming that you know what needs to be learned, and that's not always the case, because we can't even predict what children or young people are going to need to know in 50 years or 100 years. What we should be doing is developing all these capacities in them that are going to enable them to see new problems and solve new problems that we can't even imagine. So taking them through some scripted computer-based program is very antiquated.
So when it comes to personalized learning, you're okay with it?
Totally. If it's real, if it's interactive and human and involves teachers and students with one another.
So there it is. Matt Damon's mom is for real personalized learning.
Capital R.
Capital R.
Capital P. Capital L.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
He is an eighth grade language arts teacher in Western Pennsylvania. He is a national board certified teacher with a master's degree from the University of Pittsburgh. He is the director of research and blogging committee for the Badass Teachers Association. And he is the author of The Gadfly on the Wall, A Public School Teacher Speaks Out on Racism and Reform. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Steven Singer.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim.
All right, first question, Steven. What are you thinking? You're a teacher. Teachers don't write books.
Well, it's a scary thing. It's a very scary thing for a teacher to write a book like this. But, you know, you get to a certain point in your career when you say, you know, I've seen all this stuff that goes on in the public school system, and most of the people who are talking about it have no idea what they're talking about. So if anyone's going to know what's really happening, it has to be one of us who says something.
All right, so you're expecting those out there who are making all of the changes to actually believe what you just said?
Well, you know what? I don't care if they believe me or not, but they're going to darn well listen to me. They're going to hear what I have to say, and it's up to them whether they believe it or not.
Well, that's refreshing. It's absolutely refreshing, and to see it, particularly as someone who is even in there daily like you are, and I, you know, not slugging it out isn't really the right term, but working with the young minds and doing the work that you do, and then have the time to actually document. And I think that's what's wonderful about what you've done here in this book, is just really documented it from that first person. I'm a teacher. This is what goes on in a classroom. And let me tell you about it. In fact, if we look at it, I just want to do a little preview. It's broken up into an introduction in three parts, but, you know, you're talking about racism and prejudice, school choice, and testing. And just so people know, this what brought the book together is really your blogging, right?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. This all came, you know, from my blog. All the writing really came from about 4 years of blogging.
So, you know, after 4 years of blogging, hey, man, take that stuff, copy and paste, and send it off to a press.
You know, it's funny because, you know, whenever I started the project, I thought, wow, this is going to be easy. I'm going to be done, you know, real soon because I can just do something like that. But it really, I was surprised at how much work was involved getting this together, because these really are definitive versions of all these articles. Whenever you write a blog, it's so spur of the moment. You know, you have an idea and you might do some research, and it might take at most a week or so to get it done. But whenever you come back and you put it in the book form, there's so much more thought involved. You go back and you edit again and again, and you check your sources even more, and you find you know, different links had died, and you find new links and add new material, and, you know, you have a chance to say it again a different way. And I spent most of my summer at my kitchen table revising and picking the articles and It was a lot of work, but it was worth it.
Well, I saw a piece where you kind of talked about that, just saying, you know, this idea that, look, I just took my blog and put it into a book. The reality is that, as you just said, I mean, blogs are, but spur of the moment, you know, when I write them, that something hits me at that moment, something I read, typically it's something that angers us, and it's same for you, and we go, wait a minute, this needs to be addressed from my point of view, and then you write it. But then, yeah, coming back and saying, okay, if I put this into a book, I'm probably going to have to rework a lot of it.
Yeah, it's definitely a different situation. I mean, a blog is somewhat temporary, I guess, or at least it's of that moment. In a book, you kind of want it to have a longer lifespan, maybe a slower burn than a blog. You know, a blog just explodes in your face, and there it is, and wow. And a book, it sort of lasts for a while, and you ruminate, and you think about it. So it's a very different experience for a reader as well as for an author.
Well, I know for me, one of the great things is that it considered my bathroom. because you look kind of funny when you're in the bathroom with a computer. I'm just saying. You know what I mean? So the book, it's still, you know, so I'll be, no, Stephen, it looks good on a coffee table though, right?
It does. It looks very good on a coffee table. It looks good on your arm. It's a great Christmas present. But I mean, in reality though, I mean, when I got the book, and I just got it myself this weekend, opening it and actually touching it and holding it and feeling its weight and its heft is such a difference of it. I mean, a physicality to it. Even looking at the same article in the book, it seems to have so much more authority,
right,
in that book to me than seeing it on the screen in that sort of fast food kind of way, you know, you get with a blog. I mean, this is a meal.
You know, it definitely is. And I mean, I've been reading and posting, you know, going on to Busted Pencils Facebook page. I try to document your work all the time and repost it as much as we can, because I, you know, get a lot of extra readership, because you definitely have been writing to the people that listen to Busted Pencils and go to our Facebook page. So, but hey, enough with the congratulations. You wrote the book. Okay, finally. Awesome. It's there. It's physical. You can hold it. You can read it. Let's talk about it a little bit, though. Three parts. You know, you take these down and you break it into racism, school choice, testing. Of all those blogs, how did you find three kind of subtopics?
Well, part of it was sort of understanding what I had written, because I had all this stuff and I had so many disparate topics I had talked about before. And it was sort of like, if I was going to distill what I was really interested in, what I had really written about and what I wanted to say, what would those topics be? And it seemed early on that definitely I had a lot of writing about racism and white supremacy and sexism and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that I knew was very important. And it went through almost all the articles that I had, but there were some that really centered on it. And then obviously there was a lot of stuff about standardized testing and about privatization. And then there were things that were harder to classify that dealt more with the experience of teaching and of being a parent and other issues. So that's kind of how the book sort of arranged itself whenever I found the articles that I thought were most important to include.
We have been talking with the brand new author, but hey, let's be honest, he's a school teacher and that's what really matters, Stephen Singer, and his new book, Gadfly on the Wall, A Public School Teacher Speaks. We were talking about parts of the book, and part one, particularly racism and prejudice, and everybody has to go out and get the book. But Stephen, I want to just kind of talk a little bit about maybe what I think were some of my favorite pieces throughout each one of these, the parts of the book. And so, hey, prejudice and poverty, why Americans hate the poor and worship the rich. Give us a sense. What was going through your mind? What's this about? What might somebody want or learn to hear? Or who'd you piss off when you wrote this?
Well, it started with someone pissing me off.
Okay.
Or a lot of people pissing me off. I mean, how many times do you talk to someone and they'll be talking about, you know, oh, those, you know, those poor people, you know, those people who, you know, should be lifting themselves up by their bootstraps. You know, I don't mind helping people out, but I can't stand these people who are getting filet mignons and lobster on my dime and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I live in a very working class community. I've always lived in a community like that. And it seems to me that a lot of us speak from a position that we don't really know. We sort of have this sort of feeling that, you know, we're losing out for somebody else. So there's people who are taking advantage of our good nature. And that's where this article came from, a response to it. I wanted, you know, once and for all, I wanted to be able to come back and say, look, you're wrong, and here's how you're wrong. Because the facts really don't support that position that there are all these poor people who are taking advantage of the system. It's really just that there's a lot of people that need help, and it's just getting worse with the way the economy is right now and the job situation. So that particular article was I wanted to prove that that there were people that really needed help, and I wanted to show that this attitude against poor people was really a kind of prejudice, and it really talked to something deep in the American soul about prejudice and judging people without all the facts of what their lives really are like.
Wow. So, in other words, it sucks to be poor.
I can tell you that firsthand.
Well, yeah. Hey, just a little background information. I know exactly where Steven Singer teaches, and I actually graduated from that high school and school district where he is, and it was working class in the 80s, and it's gotten lower working class since then. And so, yeah, this idea of bootstrapping, we heard it a lot growing up, and as the mills were closing, but now the mills are gone, and all of the kids in your school now can go shopping where the mills used to be, right?
That's true.
Except
that's
definitely true. But with no money.
Yeah, well, they don't go there.
Right.
Much shopping, but people go shopping there.
Right. That's whole. They work there now, though.
Yes, they do.
Right.
They do.
Yeah, the whole class thing there. Okay, school choice. All right. The racist roots and racist indoctrination of school choice. You hit some hard balls here, man.
Well, I mean, there's some hard balls to be hit.
Okay. I mean, so really, you're linking up school choice and racism. And typically, though, we hear from school choice advocates that actually school choice is a response to racism in the crappy schools that have come out of. And in fact, if you give kids a choice, therefore you're not being racist. And you're kind of coming back and saying, whoa, hold on. So what are you saying?
It's really just a matter of looking at the history of this country. It's really no secret. The secret is that it's a secret. All you have to do is look to see where the idea of charter schools and voucher schools really come from. This comes from Brown v. Board. This was a reaction to Brown v. Board.
That's Brown versus the Board of Education, just for a listener who wasn't for sure. You know, V means versus. Okay, but yeah, classic civil rights case that desegregated schools.
Yeah, I mean, this was... when it comes to privatized education, this was, in the South, at least it started there, a way to facilitate white flight so that you could have schools just for white kids. And if they wanted it, maybe, who knows, schools for black kids. That's really how charter schools started. Mm. And today there's this sort of whitewashing of this whole segregation ethos and calling it a civil rights issue when it really isn't. I mean, there's a civil rights issue there, but it's not the one they're talking about. The civil rights issue is that what they're doing violates children's civil rights. So it's very cut and dried, very much, very easy to prove where this came from. And I think when even critics of my work have looked at articles like this, really the best they can say is, well, it doesn't really matter where it came from. What about now?
Right.
Yeah, but look where it came from.
Hey, we don't want you to look there, man. You know, that's it. Well, let's jump to number three, my favorite, and testing. But check, you know, standardized tests have always been about keeping people in their place. How dare you, Stephen? Standardized testing is the way to advance through school and become awesome and get into Harvard.
It's, again, that secret history, which should not be secret.
Okay.
I mean, these are facts. I mean, this is so provable. It's a shame. It's a damn shame that everyone doesn't know this. And this one, when it comes to school choice, I kind of knew that.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of knew that after teaching for a while and knowing about the charter schools and the voucher schools. But when it comes to the standardized tests, some of the stuff I found there was absolutely staggering to me. The connection between standardized tests and the American eugenics movement and the Nazi Party. It sounds crazy. It sounds crazy when you say it,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it's true. The fact that in this country, the United States at the beginning, at the turn of the century, in the early 1900s, early 1920s, that army psychologists during especially World War One used this idea that certain races have certain characteristics in terms of morality and the quality of the character of the people, that they use these ideas to justify racist attitudes, and they use testing, standardized testing, to prove it was okay to select against people of different races. And it started in the army. And it became the SAT test, which we still have today in some form.
Right.
And these ideas just permeated our schools and our complete idea of education for so long, until after World War II, when we turned against them after the Nuremberg trials, when the literal Nazis were saying, "Hey, we learned it from you guys." And now we're coming back to it, and we're just leaving out the Nazi and the eugenics stuff, but it's the same stuff. It's appalling.
It's appalling. We just touched on the book, and for the listener of Busted Pencils, get out there, grab this book. It's Gadfly on the Wall, A Public School Teacher Speaks. The author is a public school teacher himself, currently doing it every day, and let's be honest, he's a badass teacher. Stephen Singer. Stephen, I want to get the book. Where do I go?
Well, right now, the place to get it is Amazon.com.
Okay.
But eventually, it'll be available at Barnes & Noble and Books A Million and other booksellers, reputable booksellers everywhere.
Hey, and we'll even make a reputable place. We'll put it on Busted Pencils, too, for the heck of it.
All right.
Okay, and then the blog address, though, if we want to keep following you?
It's gadflyonthewallblog.wordpress.com.
Okay, and we'll put a link to that. Stephen Singer, hey, man, thank you for being on Busted Pencils today, man.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I got to give it to you. You busted pencils.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
We have a new guest. She's an assistant professor in the College of Arts and Sciences at Trinity Washington University in Washington, D.C. She is also a badass teacher, and she is a frequent guest to Busted Pencils. Welcome back, Denisha Jones.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Hey, we love having you, Denisha. So, new blog at Defending the Early Years. You go out and make this profound claim. Teachers need to play too. What?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of profound, isn't it? But the more I think about it, the more it's like, this makes sense, right? I had some really great experiences playing, And it made me remember how it's good for teachers, too. We know how good it is for children, right? I hope we don't have to convince any of your listeners, but just in case we do, play is the number one way for children to learn and develop and grow. And we know that, right? So, but what happens when teachers play with children? Guess what? It's amazing.
Real, so it's not just, you mean like I shouldn't just go into like a sandbox myself and have fun and play. You're actually talking about teachers engaging in the act of play with the students while they're engaging in the act of play.
Yeah, so typically in a classroom, the teachers, students go off to play, and teachers might come by and check in and ask a few questions.
That's when I go, you go and get coffee.
Yeah, or you shouldn't go and get coffee, and you shouldn't be on the sidelines talking about the latest episodes of How to Get Away with Murder.
Right.
You should be observing them, but actually getting in and playing. So as I mentioned in the blog, I teach religious education at my church, and we have Choose Your Own Adventure. So we, as the adults, go with the students into an adventure setting. So I picked the studio room, which has a big dress-up area. And, you know, the kids are not really doing anything, so I said, whatever. I went to the dress-up area, and I started dressing up and putting on wigs and costumes, and it felt great. And we were and then they came over and they started dressing up, and we were laughing and talking, and it was just so much fun. I forgot that I was the adult supervisor for when someone came in looking for the adult. It was like, oh, here I am in a wig down on the floor, you know, playing with the kids. And it was just, it was relaxing for them and for me to really engage, right? I still remember to like have higher order questions with them, higher order thinking and some conversation and drawing out some of the themes we were working on. But I was playing with them. I wasn't afraid to put on the silly costumes, and that was a big part of it, too.
Well, but think about what you just said, though, too. I mean, as wonderful as it is for the students to engage in that play with you and for you to engage in that, it sounds to me like the other benefit from your point was you yourself got to enjoy being with children.
Yes, absolutely, right? Typically, you know, we're so worried about their behaviors and whether they're learning that a lot of the test-based accountability that we're seeing is taking the love out of teaching, right? The love that we have when we're with children is being turned around. I spoke recently at a anti-testing forum with Chicago Teachers Union, and Michelle Strader Gunderson was saying how the testing, it turns her into the teacher she doesn't want to be, right? And so again, when we play with children, we get to reclaim that space, right? We get to go back and say, this is what I want to do with children. I want to be at their level and play with them and do dress up or play with Legos, build something with them, or do an arts and crafts project with them. Now, of course, you know, when you do arts and crafts projects with kids, you have to be careful that you don't do something really elaborate and beautiful that they can't do, right? It makes them feel kind of look at your drawing and look at my drawing.
Well, let me tell you, when I do arts and crafts with kids, it's the other way around. I typically am the one embarrassed and go, oh my gosh, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But it does. It changes your relationship with them because you just get to enjoy yourself. And that's really important to see kids enjoying themselves and for them to see you enjoying yourself too.
So a dress-up area, and I would encourage everybody listening to go to DIYproject.org for Denisha's blog about Teachers Need to Play and scroll to the bottom of the page to check out Denisha in two of the dress-up costumes. So, Denisha, describe for me the costume, and it's on the left. Looks furry and a big hat.
So there was this big hat, and again, like I didn't want to put on or some clothes, of course, you know, I'm not young enough to fit into anymore. So I went for the big thing. So one's this big wavy hat, and then there was all these scarves, right? And so a lot of the girls didn't know what to do with them. And so we tried to see how many scarves we could wrap on each other. And we talked about how we felt like, you know, those books where they showed those old ladies who would get all dressed up and go have tea, right? So we were practicing wrapping our scarves on and talking like it was time for high tea. The other one was I call a colorful headdress almost, and it wasn't really a part of a Native American thing. It was just created by the kids, and they kept it there for dress up. Was it just another headpiece? So I think a lot of it is what you put on your head is really powerful. There's all sorts of things in dress up areas, whether they're hard hats or other things, and that's a great way to get, especially boys, to get them in the dress up, right, is to have different types of headpieces. And then of course scarves and capes and all those things are really great too.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. You know, one of the things that's so easy for an elementary school teacher, I did this when I was teaching fifth grade, when I was teaching second grade, is that I had a hat box. And so as you just pointed out, it was so easy to use those hats for you as the teacher to, you know, kind of shake it up a little bit and transform yourself and become somebody. And so just this idea of so Denisha, I like this idea of playing with children and helping them learn by being in a playful mood. I don't know how to do it. And here you go. It's like, well, wait, it's as simple as finding some hats.
Yeah, it starts with hats. It starts with just being where they're at. So I remember, and I wrote about when I was a preschool director, I'd go around and give breaks, right? That's how I got to spend time with the kids. I'd go give the teacher a 15-minute break in the afternoon to all the classrooms, and they'd always come back and they would laugh because I'm wearing butterfly rings and a tutu, and I'm just, because the little girls would like dress me up right away, and you know, I'm still circling in the room. I think, you know, I have a student teacher now, and she plays with the children, but she gets lost in the play and she forgets to look around on the other children. So that's, you still have to remember that you are the adult and you have to be able to move around. So when I came into a room to give a break, I would immediately get dressed up, and then I'd walk the room and check on the kids in the blocks and check on the kids in the manipulatives and at the science table and speak to them, right? And I might do a quick build something with them, but you have to, you know, keep eyes all over in the back of your head when you're a teacher, even when you're playing. But it's not just sitting next to them saying, what are you doing? Tell me what you're doing. It's actually doing it with them in a playful way.
Well, the blog title is Teachers Need to Play Too. You can find it at Defending the Early Years. That's DEYproject.org. Denisha Jones, thanks for busting pencils.
Thank you.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
If you have not had a chance to check out the documentary Backpack Full of Cash, narrated by Matt Damon's mom's son, Matt Damon, you should. BackpackFullOfCash.com. Check it out. Here are the creators of the film, Sarah Mondale and Vera Agnew, taking on that famous Alfie Cohn question, what are the schools our children deserve?
Well, like John Dewey said, they're the schools that we want for our own children. We should want those for everybody. So when we were filming Making Backpack Full of Cash, our new documentary, I guess the schools that I saw that I thought were really the schools that all kids deserve were in Union City, New Jersey. And that district, there was a book written about it, by a man named David Kerp, and those schools, they're seen as a possible model for the country because they're well-funded due to some court cases. These are underprivileged children who a high poverty rate in this district and many, many immigrants. They have fantastic schools. You get this feeling of excitement when you walk into those schools. They have universal preschool, very high quality, with kids exploring, and the teachers are very, very well trained. The teachers are obviously happy to be there. Many of them have been there for a long time. The kids seem genuinely excited about learning. Many of them are working on projects and groups and very high-level thinking going on in the high school. It just seemed like a wonderful public school system that could serve as a model. So that's the kind of, I hope people will see the film, they'll see those schools. Those are the kind of schools I think all kids deserve.
Wonderful. Vera, what are the schools our children deserve?
I think all our children would benefit from well-resourced schools that have a variety of programs to interest all different kinds of kids. And as Sarah said, that is the kind of place we saw in Union City, and it was truly remarkable, the array of programs and the sense of energy, and there's no reason, if we chose to do that and invested in that kind of education for every child, I don't see any reason why we couldn't do that in this country, urban, rural. It's just a choice that we're making, whether or not we're going to invest in schools like that for everyone.
Just thinking another thing when I think about your question, the schools that everyone deserves for, one important thing is that original idea of the common school back in the 19th century where kids from different backgrounds, rich and poor, would go to school together, where the public school as a kind of civics lesson in getting along with other kids. You know, I was fortunate to go to schools that were very diverse in Washington, D.C., and I really value that experience and think it's a value that we need to maintain. You know, that's a big part of public education that is completely avoided when you start talking about vouchers and charters. But that idea of going to school together, learning from one another, and, you know, forging the haves and have-nots going to school together, that it will benefit the country as a whole and society. I believe in that ideal, even if we haven't always, attained it.
Want more Busted Pencils? Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play, and log on to our website, bustedpencils.com. Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. Here is your moment of Zinn.
If you join a fight for social justice, you may win or lose, but just by being part of the struggle, you win, and your life will be better for it.
My thanks to Matt's mom, Steven Singer, Denisha Jones, the Backpack Full of Cash ladies, and you. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.